Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
America's favorite sport has become a guilty pleasure.
The NFL under fire again. New outrage over players accused of domestic violence. The Dallas Cowboys signing defensive lineman Greg Hardy to a deal worth up to $13 million, accused of attacking his girlfriend.
Just 3 days ago, we learned of the medical conclusion that the multiple on-field concussions suffered by former NFL safety Andre Waters led to his depression and his suicide in November.
I've had times where I've been hit immediately and I've seen stars like in the cartoons.
If I had a son, I wouldn't necessarily discourage him from playing football, but I don't know that I would encourage him to play either.
Those last two speakers were former NFL players Thomas Jones and Troy Aikman. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Despite all of the things that make us uncomfortable about football, it seems we cannot get enough of it. TV ratings for football dwarf all other sports combined, with fans who manage to connect over their favorite teams across social, economic, political, and racial boundaries. And that, as my guest will argue, is something to celebrate in an era when Americans find themselves increasingly divided. Greg Easterbrook is a contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly and a former columnist for ESPN.com. His new book is called The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football. Greg, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
What do you love about just sitting down to watch a football game?
Well, football's a fantastic sport. It's the one, happens to be the one that I like the best, and I attend and watch way too many football games a year. But I also think it's the best sport for the United States. It's complicated. It's expensive. It's loud. It's overdone. And haven't I just described the United States by saying those words? And it's a celebration of power in good ways and bad ways. And the United States is the most powerful nation in the world. We can't make up our minds as a country what we think of our own national strength. And I don't think it's a coincidence that our national sport is an athletic expression of trying to figure out what the proper use of power is.
You note a really interesting parallel between the ascension of football as the national sport, and the end of the Cold War, when America became the world's most formidable, unchallenged superpower.
Yeah, people have been playing football in the United States since the late 19th century. It's been popular for about 100 years, but the huge increase, the skyrocket in ratings, the increase in total number of high school football games, increase of the youth level everywhere, college on television, everywhere you look, there's football. That happened in the last quarter century. Well, what else happened in the last quarter century? The Cold War ended. Now, of course, the fact that two things happen at the same time doesn't mean that one proves the other. Cause the other, but they may very well be related. And I think at the very time that the Cold War was ending and the United States was trying to grapple with this incredibly complicated problem, which we grapple with weekly, including right now over the ISIL question, is how do we use our power in the world? We got more and more interested in a national sport whose central question is how do you use power?
Some of the things that we admire about football players and their skills are reminiscent of the things we have long admired about war heroes.
Yes, the other thing that's been happening roughly in the last quarter century is the Vietnam War was winding down. It had caused, for good or ill, set aside the ethics of Vietnam. It caused American society to have mixed feelings about what it meant to be part of the military and the life and death questions that are involved. Yet the military culture has always been intertwined very deeply with American life, not exclusively at the small-town level, but especially at the small-town level. People wanted something else to fill that void, and the something else was football, which is amazingly similar to a military organization, except without the complicated life-or-death questions. The coaches are like generals. The players always say, yes, sir, the purpose of the game is to seize the opponent's territory. It's military in a lot of ways, and it took the role that the actual military had in the life of a lot of American small towns.
People are probably more likely in some communities, at least, to have played football than to have been in the military.
Today, that's true. Yes, it's today the chance that an American male of military age will serve is less than one third of what it was during the Vietnam era, and I think the chance that a member of your family will have served or be close be the spouse of or close or related to someone else has served has dropped to a really low number. Well, the chance that someone in your family has played, coached, or otherwise participated in some level of football is way up.
I was fascinated also by the way that you explore the fact that football remains a very male realm, which is not to say that women can't enjoy the game and don't, in fact, enjoy the game, but they will never be stars on the field, where women are becoming stars in a lot of places that used to be exclusively controlled by men.
Well, yeah, think of what else has happened in the last couple of decades. Prejudice against women has not disappeared, certainly, but it's in decline. Women have taken over the higher education scene. There are 60 women graduate with bachelor's degrees from colleges for every 40 men that do today. Women have taken over big corporations and not just consumer products companies. The CEO of Lockheed Martin, the world's largest defense contractor, is a woman. We've had women as secretaries of state, a woman Nancy Pelosi running the House of Representatives, and I don't know if it'll be Hillary Clinton or not, but it's obviously at this point simply a matter of time until there's a female president. Well, in the main, all those things are good, but there's a lot of men who don't like that. Where can you retreat to that you know that women are never going to take over? The only place you can really be sure of is the realm of football.
So we can, as the hour goes on, specifically address the problems that people have with football lately, but they're arguably not new problems. So why do you think so many people have become uncomfortable with how much we love football lately?
Well, I think it's actually a healthy thing for the sport that people are becoming uncomfortable. It's led to some reforms and needs to lead to more. But I think you see two things happening at once. One is, in general, as a society, problems are coming out of the closet. And we see, to the extent the NFL is a mirror, we see the problem of domestic violence coming out of the closet, kind of using the NFL and the Ray Rice video as a way to do that. But it's one of many things that we should be talking about, that we should be honest about, and we're finally talking about and being honest about. The problems of football fall into that category. And the second thing is just more has become known about neurology in the last 20 years. The neurological harm done by football was not well understood 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. Today, whether CTE is proven as a threat or not, I think that's a gray area, not meaning the gray area of the brain, but a gray area of research. But we just know more about neurology than we used to know, and the more we find out, the more uncomfortable it makes you.
Well, let's talk about violence in general among NFL players and reports of domestic violence in particular, and you mentioned the Ray Rice video. Are those stories an indication that NFL players are more likely than the general population to be abusive toward women or violent in general?
I don't know if you can answer the question exactly the way you just phrased it, Chris. I can tell you from statistics that about 2% of NFL players are arrested in any given year. And one of the problems with criminology statistics is that we have better data on arrests than we do on dispositions of cases. But anyway, 2%, one NFL player in 50 is arrested in any given year, and that's certainly a disturbing number. If you look at American males of the same age, it's almost 8%. So a male is more likely to be arrested if not a football player than if a football player. Now, again, we're using arrest statistics. We better have dispositions. And of course, the arrest statistics may be clouded by the fact that you don't know the statistical effect of the one career criminal who's repeatedly arrested. But in general, it looks like NFL players are less likely to be arrested than men of the same age. It's just that when it happens to an NFL player, everybody hears about it.
Of course, the question, it's reasonable to ask whether some NFL players might be doing things that would get them arrested if they weren't famous and wealthy.
I think you should assume that they are. But even if you assume that, you still in general, if you look at big data, it looks like people who aren't NFL players are more likely to be arrested than people who are.
So, Greg, to the extent that football provides a lens through which Americans can examine a number of different social issues, including domestic violence, are we actually doing that?
Well, a little bit. The metaphor I use in the book is that the NFL is a mirror to larger questions in societies. And one of the chapters of The Game's Not Over is titled, "Hey, That's Me in the NFL Mirror." Things that we've seen about that have become controversial about the NFL in recent years, domestic violence certainly one, bullying another. A generation ago, bullying was just a fact of life. You were supposed to live with it. As of 3 years ago, the bullying of an NFL lineman, a guy who could lift a railroad locomotive over his head, quit the sport because he was sick of being bullied. And if bullying can happen to someone that big and that strong, then it can happen to anybody. And that put bullying into the national conversation in a way it had never been before. I think what's about to happen is I think there's a huge prescription drug abuse problem in the NFL, and that the facts, once they come out, are going to force us to look at the prescription drug abuse problem in the country writ large.
Let's talk about prescription drug abuse. A lot of people are aware that these, you know, people go around and they pill shop for different doctors to prescribe things. It would seem that in the NFL, this habit for many might begin with the fact that they actually are legitimately in physical pain.
Yes, football's a grueling sport. There's a lot of pluses to playing football. It's a lot of fun. You learn self-discipline. You learn teamwork, et cetera. But it hurts. I mean, there's just no way to get around it. After a well-played football game the following morning, everybody hurts. So a football player has a legitimate therapeutic reason to go to the trainer and say, can I have some pills? But I think they're doing that on far too much a basis. The NFL does not disclose its levels of even legally obtained prescription drugs. They won't tell you that. I've asked the NFL for it many times. They won't disclose that number. They don't have to disclose it by individuals. You can anonymize data so that nobody's privacy is compromised. But they just won't tell you how much narcotic painkiller they're using. And I have a feeling the answer is they are using a lot. And so these guys play on television. They seem completely fearless, recklessly throwing their bodies around like great heroes as if they felt no pain. It's because they don't feel any pain. And then high school boys imitate that and harm themselves in ways that should be avoided.
Do you think the NFL encourages players to use painkillers prophylactically?
I've talked to some about that. Well, first, prophylactically, yes. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard of Toradol. This is nasty stuff. This is an amped-up version of the same basic substance, naproxen, that's in the over-the-counter painkiller called Aleve. Mm-hmm. You can have Toradol injected into your body, and it has a much stronger effect the way anything injected into your bloodstream would. And a large number, if not most, of the players in the NFL are being injected with Toradol before games, that is when they're feeling fine. It's one thing to say, I need a painkiller because I'm in pain. To take a painkiller when you're not in pain so that you can ignore the pain when it arrives, that's bad for your health. And I think if people knew how many NFL stars that they revere are getting big needles in their butts before games so they can play with painkillers in their systems, I think people would be upset by that number.
I'm not happy to know that there are perhaps abusive levels of drugs being given to these players, used by these players, but it does help me understand because, you know, you see them get knocked over, and I am not tough and strong, but I think I would just, like, run off the field crying and never go back. Maybe they would do the same thing if they didn't have this extra help.
Well, anybody who makes it to the NFL level obviously is a tough guy. They're all tough guys, and they have hard-edged attitudes toward the world, and as far as that goes, I have no complaint with that. You know, a basic thesis of the game's not over is that you shouldn't feel compunctions about NFL players because they're adults. They make a free will informed choice that has a good cost benefit trade off to them. They average $2 million a year and they get a great lifestyle in return for their physical suffering. So I don't see why an adult shouldn't be allowed to make that decision. The question is, should a child be allowed to make that decision? That question applies to the harm done in high school and in youth sports.
All right, we're going to talk more about that after this break. My guest is Greg Easterbrook, contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly, and author of a new book called The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football. If you'd like to weigh in on this, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. By the way, we're asking Think listeners to help us choose the best shows of 2015. You can vote for your favorites at kera.org/think, then tune in the week of December 28th to listen to The Best of Think. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Greg Easterbrook.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with former ESPN.com columnist, now contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly, Greg Easterbrook. His new book is called The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org, call 1-800-933-5372, or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Greg, so you mentioned the risk of chronic traumatic encephalopathy called CTE, which is this brain condition that has been associated with repeated concussions over the years. You mentioned that you're not sure the science is settled. I've seen reports of a lot of really good science that says, indeed, repeated concussions are a risk at a variety of ages, but as you mentioned, particularly in early life.
Well, here's the thing about CTE and It's a double concern, not just caused by concussions, but that lots of subconcussive impacts or just constantly having your head hit could also add up to CTE late in life. That's an equal concern. So far, the research that's been done has been done almost exclusive. CTE can only be diagnosed after death with a brain autopsy. Such autopsies are very rare. So far, they've been done mainly to former NFL players and to soldiers who were killed in explosions. So you're looking at a subset of the population and finding CTE in it. It is, in truth, very disturbing. What isn't known yet is, does everybody get CTE as they age, or is it a common condition? I think one reason the NFL was so eager to sign its lawsuit settlement with its former players, which is hasn't yet been approved by the federal judge but is likely to do, is they wanted that deal signed before such time as it may be proven that CTE is much more likely to happen to football players than to people as a whole. I don't think that's been proven yet. I think Bennett Omalu, the guy who's fictionalized in the movie, the Will Smith movie Concussion that's upcoming, has done some really good work in calling people's attention to this possibility. But I don't think he or other researchers have yet proven it.
All right, let's talk about children, because you do have concerns about boys playing tackle football, particularly before high school.
Yes. There's no reason why an adult shouldn't choose to to play in the NFL if he's capable of doing this. Wholly different question at high school and really different question when you get to the youth level. There are roughly 200 concussions a year in the NFL, and although subconcussive impacts, yes, may be just as important. Concussions are the easiest thing to measure. There's about 200,000 concussions in high school and youth football. Almost all of them happen to people who legally are children. The overwhelming majority of high school football players, they may have a great time, they may have a great learning experience. Only 1 in 50 will get a boost to college. So for 49 out of 50, football's over when high school ends, and yet they're running this high concussion risk. And when you look at youth players, there's no reason at all anybody under the age of 13 should put on pads and play tackle football, because the brain case is much more vulnerable than it is in a mature adult. The contact may be lower speed in youth leagues, but the brain is much more vulnerable, and the neck is also more vulnerable. Bennett Omalu, we just mentioned him, the guy who the movie Concussion is more or less about, has a piece in the New York Times today saying that no one under the age of 18 should play tackle football. I'm not sure I agree with that, but I would agree in a minute that nobody under the age of 13 should play. And don't take my word for it. Take Archie Manning's word. Archie Manning, the father of Peyton and Eli, would not allow them to play football in helmets and pads until they started middle school, because he knew that the health research showed that it's exceptionally dangerous for a young boy to get hit in the head.
That's a tough case to make in Texas, as I'm sure you know.
Yes, I know, but these are the kind of things you have to face. Just because football is so popular today, and I know Texas football is wonderful, and hey, if I could be there for the Class 6A championships a week from Saturday, I'd come, because I'm sure there'll be great games. But you have to face these things. If you want football to be around for the long haul, there is some possibility it will end up just plain outlawed or litigated out of existence. That's probably more, the latter being litigated out of existence is probably more likely. So the way to avoid that is to reform the sport to make it as safe as possible now.
Is there reason to be concerned for those who do hope that they'll get that big break and play ball in college, maybe get a scholarship or even play in the NFL, that if they delay practicing tackle football, somehow they will be athletically less talented, less skilled than those who don't delay.
I don't think that's a factor at all. It sure didn't seem to hurt Peyton Manning and Eli Manning, did it?
Well, they're pretty special, though.
Well, they are special, but I think if we look at their smart choices, we'll say these guys made smart choices. So how about if everybody makes a smart choice? Antonio Gates, the leading active touchdown receiver in the NFL today, not only didn't play in youth level, he didn't play in high school, he didn't play in college. There are lots of successful NFL players who did not start playing football, at least until they were in middle school, and I would say probably about a, I don't know what the number is, but a substantial number of NFL players who didn't start playing until they were in high school. Yeah, if you don't start by high school, your odds of going on to college are probably going to drop quite a bit. But much as I like youth leagues, they're sort of fun, and many youth league coaches are very conscientious men and in some cases conscientious women. Kids under the age of 13, just the risk-reward factor for them is so high on risk and so low on reward. It just shouldn't be played at that age. High school is plenty soon enough to start.
What about the risk and reward of something like a college scholarship? So many young men are encouraged to put a lot of eggs in the basket of football, hoping that that will pay their way to school. And ironically, they pay less attention to their studies.
Yes, I have a chapter in The Game's Not Over that's titled, Is the NFL Bad for Boys and Good for Girls? And another thing that we've seen in this last quarter century of the explosion of popularity of especially the NFL, but also college and high school football, is that girls and women are doing much better in high school and college in terms of GPA, graduation, any metric you want to use. Boys and men are declining. This is happening at the same time that boys are obsessed with football. Lots of girls are fans of football, but hardly any play it. So the health effects of football, of the health effects of head injuries are concentrated on boys and young men. The distraction from high school GPA and extracurriculars is also concentrated on boys and young men, and we see that boys are doing worse in school, girls are doing better. Probably the main reason is that girls and young women are working harder than boys and young men are. But I think football's a factor, too. A lot, just a huge numbers of tween and teen boys are dwelling in what, in The Game's Not Over, I call the grand delusion of high school, and that is, I'm going to get recruited, I'm going to get a football scholarship, I'm going to play in the NFL, I'm going to be a star, I'm going to be on SportsCenter, I'm going to drive a Ferrari. What 16-year-old boy wouldn't want to live in that fantasy? But the odds of that actually happening, of a high school varsity starter ending up in the NFL, is about 1 in 1,000. And the odds of a high school varsity starter having a long enough stay in the NFL to count as a career, since the average player leaves after 3.5 years, the odds of the high school varsity starter having a career in the NFL, 1 in 4,000. Whereas if you get your GPA up, if you have extracurriculars, if you get regular admission to college, where most colleges have more regular financial aid to hand out than athletic scholarship money in the first place, the odds of you landing a good job in life are very high. So I think football is distracting boys much more than girls from the need to go to college and graduate. And what do we see? Boys are doing worse in college and girls are doing better.
You mentioned, Greg, that average tenure being 3.5 years. I learned from your book that that specific time period is no accident.
No, it's no accident. If you stay under the current collective bargaining agreement, it's been approximately this way for about 20 years. If you're in the league for the fourth year, you then vest for considerable benefits, 401k matching, lifetime health care, etc. They're benefits that any athlete would want, certainly. But an awful lot of NFL players are cut when they're about to reach their fourth year and replaced by a younger player who is very eager to play for less and for no benefits.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bruce in Arlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just want to say a few points. I kind of disagree with the premise that I think, in my opinion, that football is going to be in decline at least in the next 10 years unless it dramatically changes. From my perspective, I grew up in the Metroplex during Cowboys' heyday, Dynasty heyday. I love watching football from the defensive and the running game perspective. But if you actually take a look critically at the sport, you'll see the NFL game, actually 11 minutes are played, of actual playing time is played, the rest is commercials. The NFL, they use they use the college sports to subsidize their minor league, paying for these big stadiums where people's kids' tuitions are rising all the time. And finally, about the concussions, I think that's a little bit overblown because other sports do have concussions. But if you look at the research, it's actually the subconcussive hits that are a bigger indicator for CTE.
Right, which is something that Greg was talking about earlier. Thank you so much for your call, Bruce. I appreciate it. Anything there that you want to respond to, Greg?
Well, certainly, football is certainly not the only sport that has a concussion problem. Probably number two is girls and women's soccer for concussions. The number of girls' soccer concussions in high school is also disturbing compared to the number of girls who play soccer in high school. But football is where the big numbers are for either kind of hit. And football is where the big numbers are for ratings and money. That's why, to me, it all sort of coalesces in the same place.
When we talk about concussions, there are sort of two schools of thought. One of them says we just need to design the perfect padding to protect bodies, the perfect helmet to protect brains. Other people say maybe if people didn't have this false confidence, they would move themselves through space with a little more care.
Well, I've heard people say, look, rugby players don't wear helmets. Yeah, and if you look at the concussion incidents in rugby, it's not encouraging either. Certainly, the modern neoprene helmet, which feels like a weapon on the top of your head, you feel like you have battleship armor on your head when you put that thing on, is, I think, made players more likely to throw their bodies around because they think the helmet itself can be used as a club against the opposition. The last 5 years especially, but 10 years in general, rules changes to discourage deliberate helmet-to-helmet impact are gradually taking effect. I think that's a mild positive. Reduction of contact practice hours, including in Texas high school football. The UAL allows fewer hours of contact than it used to. I think that's a mild positive. I think there's more to be done.
There is still, there may be less contact practice, but there are lots of school systems that have instituted these things called, are they like optional practices or non-mandatory practices, which in fact are usually not optional and are mandatory?
Well, of course, if you want to start in a high school football team, everything that's called optional by the coach is mandatory. If you're not there, you're not starting. But think of Texas's role in this. Texas led the 7-on-7 revolution in high school football, which began very roughly around the year 2000. 7-on-7 leagues, for your listeners who don't know it, are an advanced, complicated form of touch football where it's only passing. There's no running the ball. There's no tackling. But you practice passing round the clock, year-round. One reason the NFL's gotten so much better at passing is that all these great Texas-bred quarterbacks who have thrown thousands of passes by the time they get to college were well-trained in it at the high school level, and Andrew Luck is only one of many examples. But because of 7-on-7 and things like that, football at the high school level is no longer a seasonal sport. It used to be that it began in the sweltering heat of August and it ended at Thanksgiving. Now it's a year-round sport. Many states, including Texas, essentially allow year-round, quote, optional, meaning mandatory, practices, conditioning sessions, film sessions, etc. And for a boy to participate in the sport means he can't do any extracurriculars. And that means that when recruiters don't come calling, as they almost never do, the boy is in a weak position to try to get regular admission to college. I think it's very cynical of adults to increase, and it's happened in many states, but Texas is one of them, to increase the number of hours high school kids are expected to participate in football as an activity that makes the adults feel more important. It makes most players less likely to get into college.
All right, let's talk about the money here. One thing that concerns you is the NFL's massive cost to taxpayers who subsidize or outright pay for stadiums they cannot afford admission to as spectators. What kinds of benefits have NFL teams received historically, and what will change now that the NFL is no longer claiming not-for-profit status?
Well, the not-for-profit only changes the way that the headquarters in New York City operates. The public subsidies mainly flow to individual teams. I roughly estimate it's about $1 billion a year in public subsidies. Plus, the NFL gets an antitrust exemption. What is that worth? What would Microsoft pay for an antitrust exemption? The NFL has one. Around the corner from you in the stadiums where the Cowboys and the Texans play, the Cowboys stadium doesn't pay any local business taxes? Are there any other businesses in Texas who wish they didn't have to pay taxes? NRG Stadium, where the Texans play, about two-thirds of the cost of building it was paid by Texas taxpayers. If you've looked at the price of a seat in that stadium lately, you're going to think twice about going if you're not on an expense account. I think it's outrageous that the public subsidizes the billionaires who are the ownership class of the NFL and then gets priced out of attending the games.
So how did this happen? How did we begin to accept the notion that taxpayers should foot the bill of having an NFL team in one's hometown?
During the Depression, there was a wave of stadium building. The Old Works Progress Administration, one of the things they did was, because there were so many unemployed stonemasons, is build stadiums all across the country. The great old stadiums of California, the Rose Bowl and the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, those were both built just as the Depression was starting. And stadiums at that time were because there was no money in professional sports then and very little in collegiate sports, stadiums at that time were conceptualized as public goods. You could pay the equivalent of $5 in today's money to attend. Anybody could come. Anybody could watch the game. It was a progressive era cause that affordable public stadiums would be good for the public. As recently as the 1960s, there was still some public investment in stadiums because there wasn't enough money in the NFL at that time to pay for them. Well, now it's 2015. The NFL's a $12 billion a year enterprise. It could easily pay its own way, but we've established this idea that the public should subsidize the stadia, and the owners are going to take the money as long as it's offered. Our political leaders need to stop offering them money.
My guest is Greg Easterbrook, contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly and a former columnist for ESPN.com. We're talking about his new book, The Game's Not Over, in defense of football. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Greg Easterbrook, a contributing editor to The Atlantic and to Washington Monthly. He is author of a new book called The Game's Not Over, in defense of football. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Scott in Dallas, who asks, can you comment on the idea that if concerned parents limit the participation of their boys in football, then players at all levels will consist of kids from lower economic circumstances, which in many cases means the African-American and Hispanic community?
Sure. I think that's a concern. First, step one is I think nobody should play pads football before the age of 13. Yeah, play flag football. Flag is a lot of fun. It teaches you how to be in the right place at the right time during football action, and that's a more important thing to learn than you're 10 years old and crashing into people anyway. So suppose that happened and there was no youth football, and football began at the middle school or high school level, depending on what part of the country you were in. Would this mean that only minority group members would play and take incredible risks? I don't think that would be the result. I think it's a false assumption that only minorities play football to begin with. Johnny Manziel, for example, who Texans know is from a wealthy white family. I think there's an awful lot of white kids who are playing football. In many high schools, African Americans and Hispanics are overrepresented on the football team. And maybe it would help if some change in the culture of football broadcast better the message that as great as football may be to play, because it is a lot of fun to play, that you're a lot more likely to be a success in life if you focus on your classroom studies and your extracurriculars, because you're almost certainly not going to be recruited to play in college. So if that turn of events got did a better job of getting the message across to minority young men that the classroom is more important than the field, I wouldn't object to that at all.
What do you think about lionizing football players and calling them heroes for our young people? There are terrific guys that are truly trying to do good things in the world, happen to be excellent at football. There are also some pretty, you know, guys who most people would not want their children to pattern their lives after.
Well, some football players are terrific people, and it's tremendously exciting to watch them play. And one of the things that I think is good about football is that the appeal of the heroes in football crosses racial lines. White parents all over the country hold African American football NFL players up to their children as people to be emulated. I see that as good. But I just used the word hero. Are they really heroes? Is it heroic to get $5 million a year for chasing a ball around the field? No, it's just interesting. What's heroic is to be a school teacher or a nurse or a soldier. Those things are heroic. Football is not heroic. So we're creating a little bit of a false god problem with NFL players. And because it's so appealing, think about, we mentioned the 16-year-old boy earlier in the show. That boy has no way of conceptualizing what the professional worlds of engineering or medicine or communications or teaching might be like, but he sure knows how to play football. So he focuses his fantasy life on that, even though he's 100 times more likely to become an engineer, a doctor, a teacher, or et cetera. And he would be better to focus his time and his energy on those goals.
Greg, what's the relationship between the team owners in the NFL and the leadership of the institution itself?
Well, the owners are the leaders. Everybody talks about Roger Goodell. Right. I realize that Roger Goodell, as the NFL commissioner, has this sort of CEO-like role in our society. We make false gods out of CEOs if we're going to talk about that problem. But Roger Goodell is an intern who makes $35 million a year. The real power is held by the owners, almost all of whom are secretive. Almost all of whom, with the exception of the stockholders who own the Green Bay Packers, the only publicly owned NFL franchise, the other 31 owners very rarely say anything substantive in public. They don't disclose anything. They receive public subsidies and yet don't disclose their financials. We mentioned Lockheed Martin, the biggest defense contractor earlier. Imagine if Lockheed Martin refused to disclose its financials. Well, that's the situation with the Dallas Cowboys and the Houston Texans. And obviously, I think that should change.
How much extra revenue does the presence of a professional football team pump into the community that hosts it?
All of the academic study shows that a community should not invest in football stadiums, that if you have money to spend for infrastructure improvement, dollar for dollar, mass transit, roads, bridges, schools, hospitals, much more productive. Some academics will argue that baseball stadiums are a plus for a community on a financial basis, but baseball stadiums cost less to build than football stadia, and you use them far more often. So the economic argument for baseball, some people think, is appealing. For football, it's terrible. Think about Glendale, Arizona, where the most recent Super Bowl was played. I was there. What a fantastic game, right down to the very last play. That game was fascinating. And the whole urban area around that stadium is pretty much bankrupt because of the money it spent building the stadium on the promise of some kind of magic multiplier effect that never happened.
You go to the Super Bowl every year. What's different about sitting in the stands there, or maybe you're in the press box, and as compared to another game in the season?
Well, we've had good luck with recent Super Bowls. You know, if you remember the 70s and 80s, there was a run of the Super Bowls being real yawners as games. But in the last decade, not every year, but almost every year, the Super Bowl's been the best game of the year. And it's one reason why football keeps rising in popularity. Any entertainer in vaudeville, Hollywood, whatever, will tell you to save the best for last. The finale should be the best part of the show. And for years now, the NFL season has built up to the best game being the last game. So it's really exciting, and that's why we long for more. But you asked, where do I sit? As a matter of philosophy, for 10 years I've been refusing to sit in the press box. I think if you sit in the press box, all you do is talk to other reporters, and you watch the game on a monitor, and you eat the free sandwiches, and when it's over, you say, hey, what just happened? I wasn't watching. If you're in the stands, you watch the game, and I'm there to watch the game.
What kind of fan are you? Are you a screamer? Are you just a sort of silent concentrator?
Well, I'm taking notes, so that puts me in the middle. But I just root for good games. I don't have any favorite team. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and like all true sons of Buffalo, I died 1,000 deaths during the 4 straight Super Bowl losses. But since then, I've reached the higher level of enlightenment where I realize if you just want to see a good game, that you're more likely to feel that your time is well spent.
Greg, it's come up a couple times over the hour that, you know, football can unite fans across a really broad socioeconomic and political spectrum. There aren't too many things that we can agree on in this way with people who look very different than we do, who live in very different neighborhoods, who have maybe very different lives.
Yeah. Think of the things in American life that you meet anybody from any social class, any race, any income, any educational level. People who are different from you, you can talk to about. Everybody can talk about football. Now, everybody may not like football. That's a different issue. But everybody can talk about it together, not always, but in general. The people who live in a city with a football team want that team to succeed. The graduates of a college want the college to succeed. If you live in the district of a high school, you want the high school to succeed. It's something we all have in common. Now, it's certainly true. You could say, well, any city with a great symphony orchestra or a great dance company or any kind of good art scene, people could come together on that too. And certainly they could. But football is just a lot more popular and involves much bigger numbers.
There are certainly people who follow games very closely and are paying attention because they understand everything that's going on. Do you think, though, that some of the popularity of football is a product of it being a cultural experience, the kind of thing that you don't feel like you can miss it and then stand around the water cooler Tuesday morning?
Well, I think that's true, and I think that's going to get more intense as people watch live television less. You know, the numbers for live television drama shows or sitcoms are steadily down. Football is steadily up because it's something you can only appreciate live. You're not going to record it and watch the game later to find out what happened like you would with some series that you splurge on. Football, somebody smarter than me, I forget who, said that the NFL has become the national campfire. It's the one thing left that we all gather around. Maybe that and the final presidential debate. Everything else we're watching on delay when we have time.
What do you think about this? It's interesting to me that people around the world are hungry for American movies and TV shows. You hear about people in Cuba getting downloads of, like, episodes of Homeland. Why is it that NFL-style football has not taken off elsewhere?
Yeah, if you're worried about China taking over the world, China will never make movies like we do, and they'll never make pizzas like we do. So just relax on that one. But China doesn't seem to envy our NFL experience. Only the United States uses gridiron-style football as its national sport. The Canadians play it some, too, but ice hockey is their national sport. I just think football is so American. It could only work here. We're the only nation that could go to the moon. We're the only nation that could support the NFL with the giant stadiums required, with all the craziness and all the money and the large numbers of people, plus hundreds of college football games every weekend, plus thousands of high school games every weekend, all involving tens of thousands of players. We're just the only country that could do it. And it says America so straight. You watch a football game, a gridiron star football game, and the word America is practically vibrating out of the TV set. That's one of the nice things about it, and one reason why I think it will always be ours alone.
There has been talk lately about actually expanding the NFL season to 18 regular season games. Do you think that's likely to happen?
Boy, I hope not. Not only would it be another increase in injury risk, but I think there's got to be a saturation point somewhere. We may not have found it yet, but it would be better off if we never find where the saturation point is. There's plenty of. I don't know anybody, even hardcore football fans, who walks around saying, gee, there's not enough football on television. We got to do something about this. I just think that more games are unnecessary.
Are there too many teams?
At the NFL, no, 32, that's enough. There may be a couple more coming. I certainly think that if the league expands, it'll expand in North America, not in Europe. Remember, Mexico City is the largest city in North America. Toronto is the fourth largest city. Both of those could easily support NFL teams, and it'd probably be good for North American cohesion if there were teams in Mexico and Canada. At the high school and college level, maybe you can argue that there's too much football, but not at the pro level.
What do you make of the fantasy football phenomenon that has seemed to take over computers all over the country within a matter of, you know, months, maybe a couple of years? It's gone from nothing to a really big thing.
Well, and it's yet another thing that's been great for NFL expansion, because fantasy football makes games that don't matter to the standings matter to your fantasy leagues. Yesterday, the Jacksonville Jaguars played the Tennessee Titans. It's hard to believe that anybody other than immediate family members of the players cared about who won that game, but every fantasy league guy cared about it, and every woman who plays fantasy league cared about it, because it generated stats that are good for your fantasy leagues.
Is the NFL getting any money? Are the teams getting any money from the fact that their stats are being used in these fantasy football contests?
Well, I think FanDuel and DraftKings and their imitators, the new fantasy league sites that are essentially wagering, although officially they're not betting, if it, actually they are. The NFL has already wrapped its arms around them. Jerry Jones has an investment. The Cowboys owner has an investment, one or the other. I can't remember which one. There's a fantasy league betting parlor at the Dallas Cowboys Stadium now. There's a fantasy league betting parlor at the stadium where the New England Patriots play. I think in the long term, the NFL is going to deeply regret this decision. It's going to lead inevitably to people wondering if the games are fixed. And the number one thing about the NFL is its product quality. The games are consistently good. If people start to say, those games in the NFL, they're fixed, they're going to regret causing people to think that.
All right, this last question I ask with no disrespect to the most passionate football fan anywhere. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that ultimately the results of a football game don't actually matter? People care about them, but they don't really mean anything, you know, the next day when you get up.
That's one of the great things about football. It's an artificial universe. You can care about it. You can get emotionally wrapped up in it. But whether the Giants or the Cowboys win a game ultimately doesn't matter. International affairs, race relations, the economy, terrible things happen, terrible, disturbing things. In football, all that ever happens is entertainment, and that's what's so great about it.
So it's just a release from all the other things that we get hung up on.
Well, some people get too far into it. Some people reach the point where they're more interested in the NFL than in real life, and that's not healthy. But if you just use it as an escape from real life, it's a really fun escape.
Greg Easterbrook is a former contributing editor to ESPN.com and now a contributing editor for The Atlantic and The Washington Monthly. His new book is called The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football. Greg, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
And thank you for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is our associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.